Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now, here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast, powered by First National. I am Adam Pawatic, sitting here with Aaron Cameron at the Land and Development Conference. Our next guest is somebody by the name of Antonia Botero. She's a principal of MAD Project. She is U.S.-based. She's invited to this conference for a couple of reasons. She is actually hands-on development, doing office to residential conversion, as opposed to the rest of us that just talk about it. So we're going into some of the challenges and successes that she's had there. But she also has a wide-ranging design background in a number of U.S. cities. And so we're going to get into some of the more recent work she's done, maybe how it compares to the Canadian landscape. So Antonia, welcome.
Thank you guys for having me.
So to lead in, just if we can do, the kind of 5-minute version of your background, how'd you get to where you are? You referenced before we started, your career in architecture turning into development, turning to the dark side. So I want to hear what moment you had where you decided you had no soul and must move over to development. What led up to that decision? But I'll let you take the story from here.
So I am a registered architect. I did train in architecture. I have a 5-year professional degree from the University of Miami. And then I went on to do a 2-year master in science in urban design at MIT. And then from there, I went to work in New York in architecture. I became registered. And I mostly, when you work in New York, you always work in existing buildings. But I was also interested in doing ground up. So I did a little bit of both, which was actually kind of neat. And we can touch back on how my experience in multifamily ground up in Manhattan actually translated really well to the conversion work. And then I worked in architecture for a while until I became registered. And after that, I always wanted to work in development. My parents were developers back in Colombia. And so I always knew that I wanted to end up there. And for some reason, it made sense to me that if you wanted to be a developer, you should know how buildings are built. And the way that you learn that is by studying architecture and then being in the field enough. And so the minute I was registered, I was like, it's time to go. And I went to work in real estate development. And so, yeah, that's when I went to the dark side. And then people stopped talking to me because I went to the dark side.
Well, it's funny. Now that you say it, I know I've heard people reference that. The battle between architecture and the design team, and then the people running the financial performers behind it. And the visions might be different. One be a beautiful work of art. The other one could be for a profitable work of art. And then that's where the conflict arises. So you're saying that the battle is real.
The battle is real and it shouldn't be. And I think that the architects that I've worked with since, because a lot of what we do is we basically hire and manage the full design team. That's part of the work that I do. And I have the unique perspective where I've been on both sides. And so I understand the requirements from the financial side, but I also understand the limits of what an architect can do. You got to follow the law. Nothing exempts you from that. And if you can't do that and meet pro forma, then your deal doesn't work. And that's just that. So there shouldn't be that divide, but there is for some people. And I think that the architects that insist on continuing that sort of war are the people who, at the end of the day, end up being a lot less successful in terms of just getting their buildings built. Financially or not, that's a whole different conversation. But if you're measuring the success of an architect to see how much work they put out in the world, you got to be completely aware that if it doesn't make financial sense, it's not going to happen. You're not putting the work out.
And then there's a balance. Sure. Yeah. I mean, volume of completions is one thing, but they also have has to be somewhat attractive, at least, or at least functional and look okay, right, and all that. Like, it can't just be these totally ugly glass towers. We're seeing a lot of, not that there's anything wrong with that, but they may not be as creative.
Well, Antonia said she spent the day walking around, yesterday walking around Toronto, so you would have seen, I guess, a lot of our brand new towers. What was your overall impression of the design aesthetic here?
I actually really like Toronto. I walked around last night and I walked around this morning, and you guys have a really cool urban fabric because you have like sort of like the bigger streets, and then within the bigger streets, and you have those smaller streets, and you have this really dense, really cool fabric. And because you have the wider streets and the narrower streets sort of within them, which I think it might be like a vestige of the way the city used to be, right? That's what I imagine. It looks like a historic urban fabric. So I thought it was really cool. I really like the international style buildings that you guys have. Like, you guys have like the big, black buildings on King Street, and like those are really awesome. And I really like it. I'm less about style and more about the way that a building addresses the urban and sort of how it shows up for the city. So I don't really mind the big glass towers. I know that some people don't like them, but I think that if they have a really nice sort of way coming into the street and they really kind of show up for the people and they're inviting and they say, hey, here's our lobby and here's this beautiful coffee shop and this beautiful space with a lot of light that you can sit down and chat with a friend. To me, that's a successful building because, you know, I get it that 99% of the people who see the buildings only see them from outside. So how it shows up for the street is really important. But know that people have stylistic preferences. I'm less about that and I'm more about like...
the engagement.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's how you create a vibrant city. It is really how you come down to the...
how do you use
town.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What it looks like is secondary to just...
exactly.
How you interact with it.
Exactly. Unless it's like absolutely horrendous, which sometimes happens. I would say that in my mind, that's the minority. And then those buildings really stand...
well, it's the architects taking the safe way out. If it's all glass, can't be horrific.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Unless it's like red glass. Or
yeah, maybe. But even that, at least the standout would be different. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry, let's back up a little bit. So Mad Project is not a development company.
We are a 4-fee developer. So we, at the moment, have not done our own deals. Doesn't mean we're not looking at them. We're potentially partnering with people. And if people are interested in partnering, they should reach out to me. But currently, we're not in any partnerships. We've looked at them in the past. But most of what we do is professional project management, owner's rep work, and we are a 4-fee developer as well. So people looking to come up with the whole thesis and the strategy of how do you address a piece of land.
And it's across North America.
Yes, that's correct.
Based out of Utah.
And New York, yes. Yes, based out of Utah. I live in Park City.
No, it's funny. It mentioned that you're from New York City, from Miami, but you live in Park City.
Yes. Well, some people, actually, I was talking to someone here, someone from Toronto, and I just mentioned I lived in Park City, and he just turned around, and he's like, oh, yeah, that is a suburb of New York. So
there you go.
Which, he's not wrong. And I'm like, hey, that's very specific local knowledge. I'm like, not a lot of people know that.
So why don't we get into the crux of the conversation just about office conversion, because you are one of the few people who have done more than one. There's a sort of a narrative out there at least in the Canadian commercial real estate community right now that there are office conversions occurring, but anybody that does one will never do it again. And so there are people that are taking that leap, doing the economics, crunching the numbers, going, okay, like maybe this makes sense. They get into it. And of course, it ends up not being the best use of their time. Partly because of the infrastructure, partly because of just the amount of labor, partly because before you start, you don't know what you're getting yourself into, because once you start pulling the layers back, it always surprises you. What has your experience been and why have you done more than one?
So my experience originally, the first developer that I went to work with in New York, they specialize in that specific niche. That's what they do.
Was it common in New York prior to the post-pandemic world?
Oh, absolutely. Well, in the financial district. So it's super specific.
If you think about New York City, I guess, I'm just throwing this out there, but a lot of legacy buildings from the 1920s and 30s that just need retrofits regardless.
Yeah, not only from that time, but also from like the 1950s and the 1960s. So that's when you got like a lot of the office boom in Manhattan. And then you had sort of the surge of Wall Street and it became, you know, what it was or what sort of still is. But then you had all these massive buildings built. And then in 1993, I think E-Trade became a thing. And then you didn't need a broker on Wall Street. So that started changing that trend. And then 1998 happened and the New York Stock Exchange moved online. And then you really didn't need to be there. And then 2001 happened with the terrorist attacks. And what ended up happening, not only obviously you had this horrible event down there that the perception was really tough. The area was destroyed. A lot of things going on culturally. But then you also had legislation that passed where you couldn't have campus financial institutions anymore. And so now you had all of these factors that led up to a lot of empty office space down there. So that kind of precipitated the demographic change where people began to see that you had all these office buildings that were empty. They were, you know, the asset price went way down. So the going in basis became pretty good. Not only that, but the zoning had changed and now these buildings were overbuilt. So they were built a lot larger than you would have been able to build today. And so that has a massive value in a place like Manhattan where like land is very scarce and you're just not going to get a better deal than that. And so then it became a matter of figuring out what, you know, how to actually address the asset. And so that developer was one of the people that recognized that trend and saw it, you know, had the forethought, saw it coming And they went and they started buying some of these and making deals and doing JVs and getting into them. So that was the first developer that I worked with. And that's what they did day in and day out. I think he's done like over 20 of them at this point. Wow. But that's the other thing too. Like, he's been at it for 20 years and he didn't really do them sequentially. Like, there was always some sort of overlap. There was always like one, two or three projects going on at the same time. And he's vertically integrated. So he's owner GC and he also manages them. I mean, but it's a tremendous amount of work. So that's how I got into it. And then eventually I had done a lot of, in the architecture, in my previous architecture life, I had done a lot of existing conditions, because if you work in Manhattan, you just do as an architect. And then I did a lot of existing conditions work, because that's what it is. Office to residential is existing conditions work. You're dealing on an existing building. And then from there, I went to work at the TWA hotel at JFK Airport, so the Aero Saarinen building. And I specifically worked, I was the project manager for that building specifically because of my existing conditions background. And what that did is it gave me a ton of skills on working with existing conditions in really complex jurisdictions. You know, at JFK Airport, we were working with, like, I think something like 23 different jurisdictions between the historic people, the Port Authority, the New York City. It was just crazy. And so that gave me the really strong foundation for my company, which is Mad Project. And we do complex projects. I mean, we also like to do the less complex stuff, like ground up development.
But take it easy once in a while.
Exactly. We take it easy once in a while. We build a hotel, like, no problem. But we, you know, we deal with, you know, historic tax credits, and we do a lot of stuff. And again, that came from my architectural background. When I was working in the architecture firm in New York, I was super lucky because I got a wide breadth of experience. I started working there right after the 2008, 2009. So I started working there in 2012, and they had just started rehiring people. So there wasn't a lot of young people in the office. And so anyone would just give me whatever work they had, which across the office was, you know, I worked on Grand Central Terminal. I worked a little bit on the Empire State Building. I worked on, like, the public areas for the World Trade Center. I worked, you know, new construction for major developers, for multifamily residential. I also worked on a historic building where we kept the facade and then we built a new building right behind it. So I had this crazy wide breadth of experience. Part of it was we were expert witness for the IRS on tax credit cases. And so we understood exactly what it took to get tax credits. And so, again, all of that experience really kind of gave me the foundation for my company now, which is, you know, we do complex projects across the country.
So that's interesting. Is this the IRS work, not to zero in on that, is that for developers abusing tax rebates?
Tax fraud. Tell us more.
Exactly. That is what it is. So okay, when someone goes and claims tax credits and they say, well, I could have built this 40-story hotel, blah, blah, blah. Like, we say, no, that's not how the zoning works. And you would have never been able to build that. And so you don't get the credits that you're saying you're going to get. And we were expert witness for the IRS. So it was, like, super specific work.
And interesting. You learned a ton.
Absolutely.
So going back to office conversion, then we'll keep exploring on different aspects. Sorry, Adam.
No. I was going to tie it back too, because we were,
there tax credits for those? You want to pull on that tax fraud? Tell me more. How did they get away with it?
Dramatic.
What lessons have you learned on this office conversion? I mean, one of the things that we always hear about right now is that one of the biggest challenges is just the infrastructure, the city infrastructure. Yeah. And obviously a residential use is totally different than an office use from just the guts and bones of the building. How have you worked around that? What are the sort of the lessons to learn from it?
So I think a couple of things need to happen. I mean, the market needs to be, we're in the right place, right? So I was
just an initial acquisition going in costs,
office valuations.
And not only that, but people need to want to live there. Because sometimes I'll get people reach out to me and say, hey, we either own this building or we're about to buy this building in this horrible, horrible area, horrible, horrible neighborhood, terrible street, terrible, terrible, terrible. I think it'll make a great apartment building. Yeah. And I'm like, did you just hear yourself? I mean, you know, people need to want to live there. And that was part of the conversation that we had in the panel today, was the market conditions need to change where the economic and demographic change is in a spot where it makes a good deal, right? Like, would you build a residential building in this spot today? And if the answer is no, then don't even. That's basic.
Yeah, of course.
Right? And you're going in basis, again, that's part of the market, right? The asset price needs to be in the right spot. There's a couple of things to keep in mind in terms of the economics. One is the carry. Like, these projects take a long time. You know,
longer than ground up development?
Not necessarily longer, but not less either. Okay. And so you're not just carrying land like you do in development. And again, that depends on the tax jurisdiction, because some jurisdictions do the valuation for your taxes based on how much you've built up to, like, the first of the year. Sometimes they do it twice a year. Like, that will vary, but you're essentially carrying empty land or empty land until you open. And some variation of that, some gradient to that, depending on where you are. Whereas if you buy a building and it exists, you're carrying a full building. And so your tax bases and your carrying costs, your utilities, all that stuff is completely different. Your loan cost, like it's just completely different. So carry is a big one. And then one of the things that I always tell people, like the time that it takes, like for demo, like when we did 20 Broad Street, I think that took, demo was a year, just demo. So because we had environmental abatement, we had asbestos, and so you have to take care of that properly. So, you know, a lot of these things are really the beginning challenges of it. So you need to going in basis and your carry. And then in addition to that, you need to really be cognizant that you're only getting the land and the structure. You're not getting any of the mechanicals, maybe except for like the major mechanical ducts, like, but even then, not necessarily. In some instances, like you mentioned, the infrastructure is really different. You know, the electrical use for a residential building is really different than an office building. The plumbing use is...
I was going to say the plumbing must be the most drastic.
Completely different.
You've got these isolated bathrooms on the sink, on top of each other all the way up. Now, all of a sudden, you've got this dispersed bathroom structure, right? If you're depending on what you're building.
Right. And you're ripping it all out. Like you're not keeping any of it. And so many instances, it's already outdated for an office use. Imagine now you're going to put like that many more people in there, you know, with a much higher demand because people are showering and
washers and dryers, washing machines. Like the amount of water use must be alone, must just be.
So you're not going to reuse any of the MEP. Like you're just not.
What's that stand for?
Mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems. So you're not using any of that. So you're getting the land and you're getting the structure, and that's your going in basis. You got to keep in mind your carry. And if those two things, when you add them up, they total to a going in basis that doesn't work from a deal perspective. It's a development project at the end of the day. Like that doesn't change. So just because you're converting, it doesn't magically make it a good deal. So it still has to work.
If my goal was 100 units, I want 100 units. How does the budget of a conversion project compare to the budget of sourcing ground up? I mean, I know it's not a perfect comparison, but it's...
Yeah, that's super tough because you can find conversion building that it'll cost, I don't know, $250 a square foot to convert. But depends on your jurisdiction. The same building in maybe a different jurisdiction that has different requirements could be $400 a square foot. And I think one of the things that, again, we were talking about it on the panel, but so when we look at the asset, the physical asset, so once you get past all the other economic stuff, like, okay, it's a good deal. It's a really good deal. We can make it work. Then you begin looking at the physical asset and how much is it going to cost? And I think I always tell people that there's three things that I look at, the three E's, which are elevators, environmental, and envelope. So your roof, your windows, and this is where like I always blow people's minds because they don't realize this is a thing. But the International Building Code does not require that you have a window at all in an apartment. And so
that's a miserable life.
So
vampires, we love it.
Exactly. So most jurisdictions, what they do when they subscribe to the International Building Code is that they have additional amendments that amend the International Building Code to have additional requirements. And in many instances, they have light and air requirements like New York City. So not only do you need to have a certain amount of light, but you also need to have ventilation, which means your windows need to open, which means that if you buy a building that used to be an office building where your windows are not required to open, guess what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to replace your entire facade. And so envelope is one of the first things. And again, that's going to be jurisdictionally specific. I started working now for the first time in a jurisdiction that does not require operable windows in a residential building. And it's the weirdest thing. But
are you designing them without windows?
No,
operable windows.
Okay.
So it's like a hotel room, which when I tell people, they realize, because people get all up in arms about it. I'm like, well, have you ever stayed at a hotel? Because most hotels don't have operable windows. Most just don't. It's like a safety thing. So, and most jurisdictions don't require that you do it. So even in New York City that requires light and air for residential, for multifamily residential, that amendment to the, well, it's not really, New York City has its own code, but it's based on the International Building Code. And
for hospitality,
it does not have the amendment or the requirement. And many places that require light and air for residential don't require for hospitality just because it becomes a safety issue at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that's all to say, like, if you look at your envelope and your roof is completely destroyed and your foundation is leaking or whatever, like, that alone can kill the deal. Environmental, same thing. Your abatement can be millions of dollars. So that can kill the deal. And then finally, the elevators. Some people don't realize, but in many instances, you might not be able to reuse the elevators that you have. And if you're completely replacing rather than modernizing, you're buying new elevators, like, from scratch. And elevators are some of the most expensive things, especially if you have a really tall building. You know, there's elevators go up per stop. So every stop, it adds more to the elevator. I mean, there's a little bit of efficiency after a certain number of stories, but then you got to figure out what to do, because sometimes you buy these buildings and they have like 12 elevators and you're like, that's not, you know, you don't necessarily need that for residential. So how are you going to deal with it if you're going to infill it? Is it a bunch of structural work? Can you recapture that area, right? Can you make it into a rentable area somehow? So those are all things that are, and again, the other thing that affects the envelope is if you have like light requirements like you do in New York, your units can only get so deep. Because, you know, your light requirement is basically calculated based on the square footage of the unit and the distance from certain area, like the back of the unit to the window. And so if you have those requirements, you may not be able to get enough units into the floor plate to make the density work. Because if you just don't...
Or you have these really bizarre shaped units, right?
And you do. And I think as long as the design is really good, you got to get pretty creative and you got to be really good with the interior design.
Kitchen on the inside.
Yeah.
Living area, bad bedroom by the window.
Well,
second bedroom with a sliding door so that it's got light, but not really. Like, how does that?
Exactly. And so that's where, because the International Building Code does not require this, you can actually have a lot of windowless bedrooms and people feel all kinds of ways about it. And I always tell people, like, it's market specific. Some markets will support windowless bedrooms. There are people who live in New York City who have bedrooms without windows. Like, I'm not even talking about the feelings. It's like the market will support it. If you're able to put up a building where people are going to rent the apartments, then great. If
at what level, I guess, is the real question.
Well, yeah. But and so that's where a lot of people make the amenities like really nice, right? Or make the finishes really nice as well. You have these beautiful apartments that are really sleek, really modern, much nicer than anything that you could possibly get, but you just don't get a window in your bedroom. And some people are okay with that.
Well, same thing when you buy like houses built in the 30s.
Yeah.
You know, this, the design style is different than a lot of chopped up rooms, minimal windows.
Right.
Obviously, the modern design is very heavy in the windows. But yeah, I mean, people live in houses in the 30s and don't complain about it.
Exactly. And I think, again, it's market specific. If you have enough supply with like massive windows everywhere and light in every single room, and you're going to go compete against those people. And so, again, that goes back to the market and the demographics and the desire to have these places. If your business plan doesn't work, let's not even get into the whole talking about how you address a 20,000 square foot floor plate, right?
Well, yeah. So to that point, maybe we should elaborate on it, because I think everything we've discussed so far, the three E's and then this issue, it sounds like they're all solvable. It's just the profitability evaporates to the point where there's no point.
Well, that's where it comes down to. Markets are probably not yet ready to accept what the value is of these things to make it work. Like,
right.
I think in every office building, in theory, is a potential candidate at some cost if the land's free or you can get it at a significant discount. But I guess just not there yet.
I don't think it's there yet. And the two things that people are watching, and I always give Manhattan or New York City as an example, not only because I'm familiar with it, but because we have the benefit of hindsight, where we've seen a lot of things that the jurisdiction has done to promote these conversions, right? So they've done, you know, there's basically zoning legislation that has gone and it'll specify, it'll say from this street to this street, if your building was built before 1977, then you've got to comply with the 1968 building or the 19 whatever code. So it basically, through zoning, they make it so that the building code is amended in order to promote conversions in certain areas of the city. And that's why you saw a lot of these conversions happening in the financial district. That's because the zoning is very specific. And it says south of this street, if your building was built before 1961, then you're able to comply with the 1968 building code. And that means that your requirements are really different than the current building code.
Like more economically favorable, I assume.
Well, yeah. And it comes also to like the width of stairs and, the, you know, certain things, even though most office buildings have stairs that are wider than is required for egress for residential, just because during the day, your occupancy in an office is actually much greater than a residential building, right? So you actually have more people trying to exit the building in case of an emergency than you would in the middle of the night in a residential use. So normally the stairs are wide enough. So that's kind of one of the concerns, but your sprinkler requirements are also kind of up to current standards. It goes to very specific things to the building code that make it favorable or easier to convert. So we do have the benefit of hindsight in Manhattan, where they've actually done this over decades, where the building code has changed multiple times to address specific areas of the city that they've wanted
encouraged.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think many municipalities seem to be coming around to that. We talked to someone from City of Edmonton where they've got that too now, where there are certain office buildings where it's just the city wants it to be converted to something else, and so they're offering sort of tax credits to incentivize.
Yeah, and New York actually had tax credit legislation that expired last year. Actually, they had two of them. They had a J51, which was specifically for conversions, and then they had the 421A, which was for multifamily residential. And you needed to do certain things in terms of affordability and other requirements in order to get those tax credits, but not the J51 actually, but the 421A you did. And those have expired. And the thing about those that are remarkable, those two programs, is that they ran for decades. And so you can't have a tax abatement program that runs for 5 years. Like, it takes 10 years in some instances to convert these buildings. So if you're going to run an abatement program, it needs to have a long-term horizon in order for that to actually have a meaningful impact on the urban. And so I just think, you know, these things take a really long time. And I think that that's one of the biggest lessons from financial district, for example, like we were just talking, like these things started like in the early 90s. And it wasn't until like 2010, probably, that you began to see people work on those, really begin working on those conversions. So it's going to take time. It's going to take a really long time. And it might be, it's not going to be one zoning change. It's probably going to be multiple zoning changes over many years to address different parts of each city. So that's a really interesting, I always like looking back at New York and how they've done it, because it's just a city that has a lot of history.
Yeah, and more than most. As you did your walk around Toronto, any office towers catch your eye for, obviously.
That one could be converted, yeah.
Because there's obviously the physical limitations too, right? You know, which you can kind of eyeball from the street.
I don't know. That's a hard one. I mean, I'm so not familiar. Like, I've literally never been here. I'm so not familiar. I was just walking around and I just really liked the city. But I don't know that I was looking at a specific building to say, ooh.
You wanted to pick one out.
This would be the third project.
Yeah. Let me call the owner.
We'll give them your number. Yeah. One of the other conversations that we wanted to have with you, just given your expertise and background, is just sort of the emerging markets across North America. So maybe you just go through what you're seeing from where you sit in your company.
So for a while, we had really cheap debt and we had really cheap capital. And so we ended up with a lot of stuff that we shouldn't have ended up with. That's kind of the short of it. I think some of that moved to suburbia reversed a little bit. People that moved out of New York City kind of just, and honestly, this is more anecdotal than anything, so like, don't necessarily quote me on it. But I have a feeling that, you know, people may have moved out of cities and then kind of realized that, you know what, it's kind of nice to live in a city. So may have moved back. Having said that, though, there are some fast-growing markets, across the U.S., and we've seen a lot of growth there. I think, for example, I'm familiar with, I know a lot of people got caught in the middle of building a lot of office at the beginning of the pandemic. And so they had no choice but to finish building those. So that's going to be an interesting, you know, phenomena as to what happens. I think the other thing that we're going to start seeing in terms of, and maybe less in emerging markets specifically, but debt maturities for office, I think that's where we're probably going to start seeing a lot of the forced sales.
There's been a lot of headlines coming out of the states of high profile mortgage defaults on office towers down there.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing that people don't realize is that before people default on the mortgage, they're going to work around. These are always private. You never hear about them, but they work it. And they figure it out and they figure something. And sometimes that gives them enough time to sell the thing. So it's a forced sale at the end of the day. There was a big one in New York recently. And I think we're just going to see more of those. In terms of emerging markets, I mean, it's tough because I feel like the markets are really fractured. And it's kind of talking about the whole return to office, which was a lot of the conversation that we had in the panel earlier. It's very market specific and industry specific. So it's a really difficult thing to paint with a broad brush. I always tell people, like, even especially in tertiary cities that are super weird, and many of them are, you know, really dependent on like one industry. And so some places are actually going to do really, really well because that industry is doing amazing. And then some places are going to do terrible because oil is down or, you know, and not right now, but I'm just saying like that's kind of how it happens for a lot of people. I know that you guys have some of that going on as well. I think it's a harder thing to emerging markets are always really hard. Because they're even more different than one metro area versus another metro area, where you can have a lot of these lessons like that we're talking about for New York, like apply, for example, to like Toronto.
You also do a lot of hospitality.
That's correct.
And that's an interesting ride because hotels were on fire before a pandemic and absolutely the worst 2 years of their life. And absolutely. Now they're back to on fire. So what's the demand side been at your business for trying to design these things? Because if I was a developer, I would be looking at the very erratic highs and lows over the last couple of years.
But I think that's hospitality always.
True. I think 5-year cycles.
Yeah. No, it really is. And actually, when the pandemic started, I was working for a national hospitality company. And so that was a wild ride. But right now, we have more hospitality work than we do multifamily. I feel like the hospitality sector just always has a lot more movement. I think there's a lot more trades in the assets. People trade in them a lot more than multifamily. And there's also a lot more work. I mean, hotels require a lot more maintenance than multifamily. So I think those are all indicators why I have more work. But having said that, people wouldn't be building new hotels if there was no demand for them. And again, some of the conversions that we're working on right now are to hotel. There's two of them. We're doing two right now. And then I'm doing one from office to multifamily.
I toured a hotel to rental in Ottawa a number of years ago.
That's easier.
Yeah. It was, I think the timeline on that one was pretty short. You get the weird sense in those units that it wasn't obviously built with rental in mind, but it worked and it was a prime location. So I'm sure they got no problem getting top rents.
Right. Again, like the market is supporting it. So like, would you live in this kind of weird apartment that is a little bit smaller?
If you could be prime location, yes.
Yeah, of course.
There will be people who will live there, and that's the first thing that you need.
And Tony, we're just about out of time here. I know there's going to be a lot of people listening with keen interest to this topic because they are, you know, just been discussed in a lot of municipalities in Canada, but in particular in Toronto. Yeah. What guidance would you give to the people that are sitting there right now? Because they're the ones going out, they're calling the owner of that Toronto office tower. And you're not quite there yet, but some people are. So what would you say to them?
I mean, the advice is to not forget that it's still a development project. You still need a thesis. You still need a business plan. You need the market to support it, both in your going in basis, but also in the demand for what you're trying to build. So number one, converting office to residential on its own is not a business plan. That's simply a tactic to meet a business plan that you've come up with that is based on your market. Or call me. You can call me.
Maybe that's the answer right there.
Antonio Bolchera. Yeah. Gonna give out your phone number? No, don't do that.
That's great. Just a touch of fear.
Madproject.com.
That's correct.
MADD. Thank you, Antonio, for coming on. That was a fun conversation.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you to First National for powering the podcast. And thanks for Informa for hosting us here at the Land and Development Conference. Thanks very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario License Number 10514 and 11252.